Okay, so we're going to kick off. My job today is basically to convince you that you do not need to be fatalistic when you're dealing with men's health. That's the whole essence, if you like, of this presentation. And I say this because, unfortunately, the medical profession is pervaded by exactly just this kind of this fatalism about men. And I've heard doctors say, God, you know, if a young man's going to take his life, there's nothing you can do about it, which is absolute rubbish. I mean, there's so much evidence now that you can actually intervene and prevent suicide. Plenty of papers out there. So I'm going to try and convince you as quickly as I can on this, so we can have a discussion about men's health. And I'm going to be mainly using the UK for all the reasons that Selwyn is saying about bringing a flavour of the UK to you. But there will be international material in here as well. And if anybody want any of these slides, I can be delighted to send them to you. Not the funny ones, just the data. So if you want them, please do ask. Okay, let's go through this quickly. Unfortunately, I have nothing to declare in terms of final. All right, so what we're going to do very quickly, I'm going to just give you an idea of what the Men's Health Forum is and what it isn't. And then we're going to look at male mortality and morbidity, mainly in the UK. And then the way that men use services, and then we're going to look at the most important bit, is what can you do about it? Because one of the problems with men's health is that everybody's very good at moaning about men's health, but they tend to fall down a bit on what you can do about it. And that's obviously the most important bit. And 10 years ago, you wouldn't have had this presentation, because 10 years ago, there was nothing really to do with men's health. There wasn't an issue. There were very, very few books out there, very few publications about men's health as an issue. I mean, there was plenty of information about the prostate and all that kind of stuff, but there was very little about men as the phenomenon of men's health. And also, just right from the outset, just to make something absolutely clear, this is not a them and us lecture, okay? And our organization, very like the American Men's Health Network, works closely with women's health organizations. For the obvious reason is that you can't separate very often men's health and women's health. The two are inextricably linked very often. And prostate cancer makes women very ill, and cervical cancer can make men very ill, and so we go on. So this is not a misogynist dream here. This is working closely with women to improve the health of both women, men, and children. And in fact, in the European Men's Health Forum, where I work in Brussels, Belgium, the head of the European Institute for Women's Health sits on the board of the European Men's Health Forum, and I sit on their board, and it's to send the message out that we will not be split when it comes to pursuing health issues for both women and men. So we're going to have a quick look at what the Men's Health Forum is. This is what it's not. It's not this, so please stop phoning in and asking for your subscription to be renewed. It isn't this, actually. Although I have to say, I did write for this magazine for 6 years, actually. And the way it happened was, there was a conference, the first conference ever in London, on men's health. And this magazine had just come out, literally just come out. And I held it up and lambasted this thing, so it has, you know, being exactly the wrong thing what we're trying to do in terms of men's health. You see, bigger pecs, sex, you know, bigger. So anyway, the phone rang when I got home. There was a guy called David Hale, who was the editor then of this magazine. And he said, "Is that Ian Banks?" I said, "Aye." He said, "Is that the Ian Banks who lambasted our magazine in public?" I said, "It was, aye. Puerile rags. It was terrible." He said, would you think of writing for us?" I said, "Indeed I would not. Put my name to that." He said, "It's £1,000 a page." I said, "When would you like the copy?" And, you know, I'm afraid every man has his price, but this is not, and this is only Selwyn, I know you won't believe this, but that is actually made a form when I first started out on this. Yeah. You can see what happens to you when you do men's health. But that's what we're not, and this is what we are. It's looking at men in the broadest possible sense, and it's not the medical model. I'm actually one of the few doctors in our organization. It's a much more sociological view of health, and we concentrate very much upon inequalities, not just the inequalities between men and women, but the inequalities between men and men. And I'll give you some examples of these on how we deal with them in the UK and in Europe. But it's all about men as fathers. It's men as husbands or partners. It's we're looking at social isolation, ethnic isolation, low-income groups, and so on. So that's what we are as an organization. And we're independent. We do take money off people like the pharma companies, but actually it's only about 2% of our income comes from the pharmaceutical industry, which is very interesting because when we first started, almost 100% of the funding came from the pharmaceutical industry, but now it's a very small percentage, and most of the funding comes centrally from government. Which then, if you like, we have to be very careful because we have to criticize the government at the same time as taking money off them to keep the organization going. And as I say, we do tackle inequalities, but also we like to consider ourselves a center of excellence of practice and to do with men's health. And the vast majority of the work that we do is now evidence-based. We don't just do it just for the sake of doing it. We evidence-base it in terms of evaluation and so on. And this is particularly important in our area because there's no link, as you know, there's no link between insight and change of behavior. There's just none. And what we try to do is produce our materials and produce our policies and so on in such a way that it enables men and governments and employers and so on to actually do something about men's health. So rather than just tell them off very often, we actually show them what they can do. Now, this is the kind of graph that politicians love, right? Because this is the everything's getting better and everything's... Oh, sorry, what happened there? Right. Thanks. Never even noticed. This is the kind of graph that governments love because it's the everything's getting better, ever upwards, ever onwards kind of graph, you see. And you can see that life expectancy for both women and men is increasing in the UK. And that is a statement of fact on the average. But the curse of these kind of graphs, which this is all aggregated data, obviously, so this is the average, if you like. But the curse of them is inside that information there lies horrors, the horror stories of life expectancy and men's health and so on, and for that matter, for women's health. And there's a guy called Alan White, who's the other professor of men's health in the UK, and his forte is scratching the surface of this information to see what's inside. And he's very, very good at it. And what he can do is he can actually take the original data, the raw data, and then reanalyze it all. And it starts to produce pictures, which maybe the governments aren't so keen for us to know about. Now, this is the countries in Europe before the accession countries, the newer countries, joined in the European Union. And as you can see, I don't have a pointer, unfortunately, but as you can see, the women live longer than do men, and again, a statement of fact, in every country. In fact, in just about every country in the world, women will live longer than men. Somalia is one of the few examples of against the other way around because of childbirth problems. So you can see women are living longer than men. Now, there are basically three reasons for why this might be true. Okay, and this is where the Y chromosome starts to come in. It could be genetic, just purely genetic, nothing else, just the Y chromosome. You have a Y chromosome and you self-destruct at the age of 55, because men do what a man's got to do, and that's drop dead early. You know, that's it, okay? So you can't do much about that, so you may as well just all go home, if it is the Y chromosome. It might be that it's the income of the man, what he does for a living or doesn't, social isolation, and also, of course, how he uses health services could contribute to living less long than do women. And then, of course, there's the most obvious and attractive explanation, that is that women kill men. Now, attractive as this argument is, it's not true. And we know it's not true because married men live longer than unmarried men, but unmarried women live longer than married women. So if anything, it's men who make women sick. It's not the other way around. My wife believes that theory implicitly. But in this graph, there's something else which gives us hope that we can do something about it. If it was genetic, and incidentally, there was a paper came out just very recently from the States saying just exactly that, that the differences was genetic. But if it was genetic, pure and simple, you would expect the ratios between the life expectancy of men and the life expectancy of women to be the same, irrespective of the country. I mean, the overall numbers would be different, but the ratio should stay more or less the same if it's just purely genetic. But when we look at 44 countries across the world, it gets even bigger. Look at the differences now. In Brazil, for instance, down the bottom down here, compared to the likes of Norway and Sweden up at the top there. So there are massive fluctuations and variations in the ratio of women's health, women's life expectancy to men's life expectancy. And in fact, when you analyze the data, this is what comes out of it. And even in there, there's more information in that, because you'll notice that some of the countries, the differences, where its difference is small, are actually developing nations. So there's even more going on inside this data than what meets the eye. So it's unlikely to be purely genetic. There's obviously got to be a genetic component somewhere in there. You certainly know that there's a higher neonatal mortality in boys than in girls. But even so, you couldn't explain it all from simply genes to when you look at that kind of ratio difference. And we don't actually need women to kill us, actually, because us men are pretty good at killing each other. And if you look at the homicide rates here on the left-hand side for men, and you look at the likes of Latvia and Lithuania and so on, massive of homicide rates, huge, compared to women on this side. But look at the countries like Germany, for instance, right down at the bottom of the graph here, same as us women. So it's not just being a man that makes you go around shooting people. It's being a man and the environment in which you are that makes you go around shooting people. Otherwise, you'd expect, again, the same kind of figures, irrespective of the country which you're coming from. And we don't even need other men to kill us, because actually we're pretty good at taking our own lives. Suicide in the UK is the single biggest cause of death of young men. Isn't that a terrible thing to say? Imagine, you as health professionals will have experienced at some point, I'm sure, suicide somewhere, either from within your family or from other people that you know, or even professionally. And that little pebble gets dropped into a pond of misery, and the ripples go outwards and outwards from the siblings to the parents to the teachers, out and out and out and out to you, and so it keeps on going. The misery that comes from that one single death is enormous. And I think it's grossly underestimated the impact it has upon people around a suicide. But again, though, look at the amounts of suicide on the left-hand side there for men compared to women. It is a male phenomenon in a great deal of sense. It is mainly men who take their own lives. And I'm going to talk about that in a little bit more detail a bit later, because there's even more information inside it. But once again, look at the difference between the countries on the left-hand side, because actually suicide is very low. Places like Greece, for instance, very low levels. But one of the problems we have, I practice in Ireland, and one of the problems we have is false reporting. Because obviously in Ireland, it's a moral sin to take your own life, and a lot of people will actually ask you not to put suicide on the death certificate, but accidental overdose or something like that. So you, unfortunately, these figures are probably incorrect, and they're probably more suicide than what we actually know. Only it's in the death certificate, it's put down as something else. And as if that wasn't bad enough, that, you know, men are taking their own lives or other men are taking their lives, we're just unlucky. We're a very unlucky sex for some reason. Because you look at the amount of deaths from accidents on the left-hand side here compared to the number of deaths from accidents on the right-hand side for women, it's quite obvious that men are risk-takers. And this is why in Ireland I tried to insure my eldest son to drive the car, and they wouldn't insure him. Just wouldn't, no matter how much. I went up to £3,000. That's a lot of dollars to try and get him insured, and he just wouldn't do it. But for the eldest girl, £300, no problem. And the reason why is in Ireland, the vast majority of the road traffic accidents are caused by young men speeding. That's what, not drinking and driving, but speeding. Total risk-taking behaviour. But the women, of course, then are much less likely to take accidents. The biggest single factor that changes that behaviour is having children. And you see the risk-taking behaviour drop off enormously. And in society, we manipulate this really quite cynically. If you think about during the war, there were two types of aircraft. There was the bomber, which had a crew maybe of six or seven, highly trained individuals, cost a fortune to put this thing together. And there was the fighter, which had one in there, and very cheap, mass-produced, very cheap to actually make. Now, you wanted the fighter pilot to take risks because you wanted them to knock out other bombers from Germany, wherever, right? You wanted to knock them out of the sky because they could destroy a whole factory. But the bomber, you didn't want the pilot to take any risks at all because you wanted that plane to come back, load up again, and go out and do it all over again. And you couldn't do that if you had to keep on training new crews all the time. So who did you put in the pilot seat of the bomber aircraft, and who did you put in the pilot seat of the fighter plane? Well, in the fighter plane, you put a young man, unmarried, no children. He'll take risks, right? In the bomber, you put a middle-aged man, married, with as many children as possible, because he will not take any risks. He wants to get back. It's a cynical manipulation, but true, and we see that a great deal. And in fact, if you think about it, with firemen, for instance, or firefighters, you actually want them to take a bit of a risk. If you're in a burning building, it's not a bad idea to have somebody to come in and lift you up and take you out again. So sometimes we manipulate the risk-taking behaviour to our advantage as society as well. So it's not surprising, actually, that men are brought up to take risks, because that is perceived by society of what men do. Men take risks. And that's a perception which pervades all the literature and films. And of course, if it wasn't bad enough that we're accident prone, we also suffer from medical conditions quite differently than do women. In fact, for all the cancers, there are only two cancers which are actually more common in women than that come to both sexes than are men. And I'm going to talk about that in a moment. But here's a myth. Here's one of the big myths. There is a myth out there that women don't die of heart attacks. It's actually the biggest cause of death for women, as it is for men, by a long way. But there's something different about it in the way that it affects men and women. And this is where Alan picked up on this. If you look at the curves on the left-hand side here for men, and you compare them to women, what is strikingly obvious is that a myocardial infarction, a heart attack, is more common in young men than it is in young women. In other words, it's a young male phenomenon to die from a heart attack. Whereas for women, they tend to have heart attacks much later in life. But there's even a twist there. Because women, when they present to an A&E, I'm a trauma doctor, A&E doctor, ER we call it here, right? Women are more likely to be sent home with a heart attack, undiagnosed, and die at home than are men. It's about three times as more likely to be sent home. And the reason why is fascinating. And the reason why is because we train our doctors as medical students, and we train women as patients to look out for the signs of a myocardial infarction, a heart attack, as if it's a man. But women don't have the same symptoms in the main as men do when they're having a heart attack. In fact, for an awful lot of women, all they'll have is sickness. They'll just have nausea, that's all. And they get sent home, because the trace is normal, which very often is, even if you're having a heart attack, as you well know. So they get sent home, they die at home. And there's a twist, if you like, to the whole tale. And an awful lot of medicines are actually tested only in men. They're not tested in women. And as if somehow it's going to be exactly the same in women, when it isn't. And a lot of medicines don't work the same way when you give them to a woman. And part of the problem has been is because we've never tested them in women in the first place. It is changing now, I have to say, thank goodness. So there's a twist in the tale. And even things like liver disease, for instance, look at the enormous difference of liver disease between men and women. Fantastic differences. But again, it's based on country. If any of you have ever been to Estonia, you'll know what I'm talking about. I mean, if they drink vodka straight out the freezer, but it's about 100 proof. It's lethal. Absolutely. It just takes your breath away when you drink it. And the other one of these is shot in the morning time, you know, before they, just to perk themselves up a wee bit. They drink a lot of alcohol in there. And not surprisingly, it takes its toll. But again, I put it to you, look at the bottom part of that graph. Because the liver disease is the same as for women. So in other words, again, it's not just that you being a man means you're going to get cirrhosis of the liver. It's being a man of where you are, your environment, and so on. It's crucially important we remember this. And again, for cancer. Now, what's interesting with these curves again is the age grouping again, because it's a younger, it's kicking in sooner, are the tumours. So, what we do know is that in the UK, men, almost a third of men, will die before the age of 65. Almost a third of them. And a half of them will die before the age of 75. In fact, there's a new stadium we've got now called Wembley Stadium. It's taken over from the old one. It holds 90,000 people. That's small by your standards, the kind of places you have. But it's pretty big by our standards. And there are more than that of men dying young before they should, so to speak. So a whole Wembley Stadium of men every year are disappearing through early death. And some of the statistics in the UK, as in the States, are really quite frightening. I think I've got the next. This is the impact of social class. I know you don't use that as a term as much as we do. But it's certainly the social determinants of health you'll see here. And what these figures are showing is that for some reason, the impact, the social determinants of health, seem to have a bigger impact on men than they do on women. And we're not really sure what the reason is. But we do see this variation, and it's very marked. And this is brand new information, by the way. There's a guy called Marmot that's just produced all this this information about the UK. Now, you probably can't see these, but the States are in here, but also is the UK. And look, they're 82-54. The life expectancy of men in East Glasgow, that's in Scotland, it's a country near England. The life expectancy, oh God, I was in Scotland, I'm dead. Jesus is well there, it always is, yeah. The life expectancy of men in East Glasgow is 54 years. That is atrocious, absolutely atrocious. And next door, and this is the curve at the bottom here now, right next door in West Glasgow, the life expectancy is over 80. So just travelling across a road into the next part of Glasgow is an incredible effect on your life expectancy. We have there's a politician, used to be a politician and a health politician in the UK called Alan Milburn. He's a bit of a hard nut. And his favourite expression about men's health was that there's an underground, a metro, the tube in London, called the Jubilee Line. And it runs right out towards the east. And as it moves further and further east, so deprivation is getting greater and greater in the towns or the areas of London as you go further and further and further east. And I had a meeting with him, and he's a bit of a bully, this fellow was, anyway. And he said, well, every stop going east, a man loses one year of life expectancy. And he said to me, he said, now, Dr. Banks, he said, what are you going to do about it? Well, it's obvious, isn't it? I mean, it's very simple. Just close the Jubilee Line down. Sort that one out. And he never even smiled. So, but it is the truth of the matter, that there are variations across such a small country as the United Kingdom, well, the countries of the United Kingdom, massive variations. And we see that also in the States. You can see your own figures there, particularly between the black communities and white communities. Huge differences in life expectancy, difference. And this is where we kick in. This is where we want to look at this and see what's going on and what can we do about it. And this is the kind of thing which really does, if you like, highlight the impact of the social determinants of health, because it's looking at something which really is a national disgrace in the United Kingdom. It really is. I mean, we should be doing a lot more. If we were losing that number of young men through terrorist action, believe me, something would be getting done by now. But unfortunately, it's still plagued by this fatalism that young men will take their lives no matter what you do about it. And that's just not true. But when Alan scratched the surface of this, he looked at the impact of social class, of the social determinants of health, on men and women in terms of suicide. Something leapt out at us so we could go to the government and show them what we're talking about. You see, the impact of social determinants of health, when it comes to suicide, have really quite little effect upon women. That's the bottom line, okay? But look at the top line. For the social determinants of health, there is a direct correlation of deprivation on men taking their own lives. And that really is truly the tragedy, because obviously there is something here in society which we should be doing something about. If this number of men are taking their lives in these areas, selected areas, and sometimes in Northern Ireland, for instance, we have whole clusters of young men taking their lives, 4 or 5 at the same time, in the same place. Horrendous. And here's another good example of this. The actual impact upon the disease itself. If you look at it in terms of... If you look at it in terms of circulatory diseases, look at the way the gap is widening with the social determinants. So you start off on the left-hand side with the high-income groups, and you get to the low-income groups, and the ratio is expanding between the two. Fascinating difference between them. And with cancer, same thing with cancer. As you move into the more deprived areas of the United Kingdom, so we find men are more affected by cancer than are women in terms of the social determinants. The red line on this slide, and you can see on the slide, the red line means anything above that line means there's more men than women, okay? So anything above the red line for all of these conditions, which are common to both sexes, means there's more men than women, okay? Now, if you look at the diseases along the bottom, in terms of the countries on the right now of the legend, you can see the massive variation, particularly when you look at lung cancer, for instance, in the middle of it. There's massive variation, there's a difference between the number of men compared to the number of women. And yet every single one of those is either at the red line, which means it's just the same as women, or above it. Every single one, look. So, middle-aged men, twice as likely to have diabetes as women. Can anybody give me, it's interactive time, okay? Can anybody give me the average delay of men for diabetes diagnosis? In other words, they put up with the symptoms for how long before they finally get diagnosed with diabetes? Anybody want to guess? What was that, sorry?
10 years.
It's 10 years in the United Kingdom, 10 years. It's 1 year for women. Which health professional in the United Kingdom, in the community, most diagnoses diabetes in men? I'll give you a clue. In women, it's the GP, the family doctor, or the practice nurse, okay? What is it for men in the United Kingdom? Which community health professional most diagnoses diabetes in men? Anybody? Opticians. And if it's opticians, it means that the retinopathy that the man has got from the diabetes, he must have had diabetes for at least 8 to 10 years. Retinopathy doesn't just go bing, that and suddenly your retinas are shut. It takes years to damage the retina. So these men must be suffering with diabetes. So if the retinas are shut, then so is his kidneys. So is the arteries in his legs. So is the arteries in his brain. With that massive delay, it's hugely important, this quicker diagnosis. And men are twice as likely not to know they've got diabetes. That's the crucial thing. They don't even realize they've got diabetes. When they go to the optician with their bad eyes, they've no idea they've got diabetes. And this is the reason why. This is from Diabetes UK, and you can see that the awareness of symptoms and the significance of them is much lower in men for most of the conditions here, except for the very, very far right, which is difficulty with swallowing. That's the only area where men match women in terms of recognizing the severity of the symptom to do something about it. And this is a classic slide which I presented in the European Parliament, and they wanted copies of this because it's so startling what comes from this. Now, melanoma is one of the few cancers that's more common in women right across Europe. You know, much more common in women than in men. But the death rate is higher in men. So a bigger incidence, a higher incidence in women, but more men die from it. Why? Late presentation. And it's even worse if the man has got the tumour on his back. Because men don't examine their backs. I have no idea what my back looks like. I could have God Save the Queen tattooed on my back and I would never know. Because I've never seen it. I have no idea what it looks like. But women examine themselves in mirrors. Look at the backside. Look at the backs. Isn't it? And the most common reason for presentation for men with a melanoma on the back is because their female partner saw it and told them to go down and see the doctor. That's the most common reason. But it's much later presentation than, for instance, if it's on the leg or it's on the front of the body, for that very simple reason. Now, much more common in women, much higher death rate in men. For melanoma. And we see that in a number of cases where they have a similar sort of relationship. Now, if I was to ask you, do men present late rather than sooner compared to women to a family doctor, how many of you would agree with that statement? Show of hands, please. How many of you would agree? Yeah. A bit reluctant here, aren't you? Right, well, would it surprise you to know there's absolutely no evidence for what you've just voted for? And it's not that you're wrong, because you are patently correct. I mean, I ask any doctor, and they'll tell you, yes, men wait too long. But nobody's actually done the basic research to find out, do men actually prevaricate when it comes to going to a health professional? And if we don't know that men do prevaricate to go and see a health professional, then we don't know why they prevaricate to go and see a health professional. We can guess. And if we don't know why, then we don't know what we can do about it. That's how bad things are, that we don't know. We just presume about the way men use health services. Now, Alan White has started to look at this, and what he found was very interesting. For all the conditions that are common to both sexes, while the condition remained minor, women were more likely to go and see the doctor. This graph, okay? Now, watch this. When the condition became serious, life-threatening, men started to come and see the doctor. I mean, that's a fascinating insight. And there is no doubt in my mind that men do wait too long before they go and see a doctor. And we may be the problem. This is the waiting room, and a family practitioner here, and this little man in here has come in. He's got an itchy part of his groin, shall we say, anything between the belt and the knee is considered a no-go area for trying to get them to see the doctor. But he thinks the receptionist knows his mother and is going to say to his mother when she goes home, your Johnny was in with that drippy willy again, and I thought he cleared all that up, you know, ages ago. You know? Now, it's not true, but he thinks it's true, which is why in the UK, family doctors hardly ever see a young man with a sexually transmitted infection because they don't trust the service. And there's something else fascinating. I asked this question in the UK, and I'm going to see if it works here. Probably won't, but let's have a go, okay? How many of you in the doctor's surgery which you go to, I know you have a different system here, but when you go to see a doctor, how many of you have got a male receptionist, okay? In other words, who takes down all the details. How many of you have got a male receptionist? Show of hands if you've got a male receptionist in your surgery. Right? One. Right? Two, maybe. Yeah. It's fascinating, isn't it? I mean, there are barriers for men to go and see to see doctors. And when you ask men, what sex of a doctor would they prefer to actually see? They don't care. They just say, yeah, as long as they're good, I don't care, kind of thing. Gay guys know, they'd rather see female doctors because they think they're going to be less judgmental. But for all this any other way, no, they don't care. But what they do care about is the interface, the person they have to talk to first before they then talk to a doctor. And they definitely don't like it if it's an embarrassing condition to talk to a woman. And here's where it starts to get financially serious now. This graph you can see here is men's use of family doctors, of GPs. You see on the left-hand side here. And you can see that women use family doctors much more than men do. Up until about the age of 55. Now, 55, 60, you know what's happening there. It's when the prostate is starting to enlarge and you're getting prostate symptoms, okay? And you know what the definition of male middle age is, don't you? It's when your prostate's bigger than your brain. And it happens around about the age of 60 in that area there, okay? And so you go to see the doctor. And one of the major causes of the presentation is not the man, because he puts up with this for an incredible length of time. Having to get up in the middle of the night four or five times to go to the toilet. It's the female partner who very often gets him to go and see the doctor. And the reason is very simple. Us caring men as we are, don't put the light on when we get up, you know, to go to the toilet. So you stub your toe on the bed as you're going back. And then you go into the toilet, because you still haven't put a light on. So you don't notice that the lid's down on the toilet when you go on the toilet. And we all know it's going to clear that up, right? So then he comes back again, and he stubs his other toe now, so he can get into bed, and then just snores for the next while, till he gets up again. And she's just lying there, wide awake. So she goes to the doctor and asks for sleeping tablets. And unless the doctor asks the absolutely crucial question, why now? Why now, Mary? After 60 years, do you now need sleeping tablets? Then they won't realize that what she needs is a TERP. That's what she needs. She needs her prostate sorted out. No, but not in air, obviously, in the other guy. And bear in mind about this, that men's perception of the prostate is very, very poor. Most men have no idea what the prostate is or where it is or what it does up until about the age of 60 when it starts to go wrong. In fact, we asked young men, do women have a prostate, but it doesn't cause as much trouble as in men? You know, it's a trick question, because you can see them going like this, going, well, men have got nipples, so maybe, you know, maybe women have got prostates, you see. Over half of them said yes, women have got prostates. Now listen, Margaret Thatcher maybe, but women don't have prostates, okay? It's a biological fact, that, right? So the insight goes up enormously when things start to go wrong. But now watch this next slide. This next slide shows me now, right? They've come to see me as an emergency. And look at the use of hospitals. It's less than women until about the age, again, over 50. In fact, almost twice as many admissions will come from men as an emergency. To a hospital. And this is the expensive bit. You know yourselves, the community physician is very, very cost effective, especially in the National Health Service, where it's a crucial part of the health service. The hospital service is the most expensive part of the whole thing. Now, I presented this again in the European Parliament, and this is the other two slides that they wanted to have, because obviously this is where all the money goes. And the reason for this is quite obvious. Women are doing better self-care, they're better health literacy. They know how to use services much better than men do traditionally. So men, it's almost like straws on a camel's back until something goes and they end up horizontal. And that's the name of the game, is keep your men vertical. Keep them upright in the community, walking around, working. Right? Don't let them slip horizontal. As soon as they go horizontal and the old pajamas go on, that's where all the money goes. Keep them upright like that, you see. So really we need to look at somewhere back this in the younger age groups of what we're going to do with them. And it's not just general practice. It's the pharmacy as well. We asked men, why do they not go into the pharmacy? They don't. Why do you not go into the pharmacy? This is the UK now. Maybe it's different in the States, I don't know. But in the UK, they don't use the pharmacy nearly as much as women do. And they say because there's nothing in there for men. You see? And then when we ask the pharmacist, why have you not got anything in for men? They say, because men don't come into the pharmacy. It's the most wonderful vicious cycle you can imagine. So what we're working very hard on, and I'll show you some examples of this, is actually to get stuff into the pharmacy so that men have got something to come out with. We asked one guy why didn't he use the pharmacy, and he said, because it's all lipstick and no spanners. And it's true. If you go into a pharmacy, it even smells like a lady's boudoir. You know, the perfumes and, you know, all that. It actually smells like that. It doesn't smell of diesel. You know, petrol, you know, it smells nice, you know. And we filmed men going into a pharmacist. And it was fascinating behavior from them, because whereas women went into the pharmacist, and don't forget, they put all the counters, so you have to weave your way through innumerable counters before you actually get to where you get your prescription sorted out, you know. But the men just walk straight in, grab a razor or whatever, and straight out again. Whereas women browse and pick things up and look at them and smell them and, you know, things that men in, race out. That's it. And there's hardly anything in there for them. And in fact, the majority of the things that are in there are for women to buy for men. And they're actually packaged to attract women, not to attract men. Fascinating. So the pharmacy is another good example, which is terrible because the pharmacy could be everything that we would want for men. It's anonymous. You don't need to make an appointment. You can just walk in. The pharmacist is hugely, highly trained, and it's right on the high street. Whereas doctor's surgeries tend to be way off somewhere, particularly in the United Kingdom, off in the leafy glades somewhere, you know, and it's not a hospital. You know, it's right on the high street. And it's open smashing hours. It's open much longer hours than doctor's surgeries are. And yet, men still don't use them. So, is it then that men don't ask for help? Or is it that the service is not actually designed well, responsive to what men want? And I actually think there's a mixture of the two here. But what we have learned the hard way on this one is that it is absolutely pointless to wave your finger at men and say, it's your fault because you're fat, you're lazy, and you're ugly, and it's all your fault, chum. You know, that doesn't work. And if you threaten men, it doesn't work. In fact, if you scare men, really scare them over a health issue, let's say lung cancer, something like that, they paradoxically take even longer to go and see the doctor. Whereas if you scare women, really frighten them, they'll form a queue outside the surgery. There is something different about the way men respond to health messages. And it's either better or worse, it's just different. And we have to be able to encompass this when we're going to produce health material. So, what's effective? Right, here's a good example of the kind of things that everybody says is never going to work, and you can actually do something about it. This was a program on chlamydia screening in the United Kingdom. Now, bear in mind, if men's insight into the prostate is poor, it's even worse with chlamydia. We asked young men what chlamydia was, and over half of them said it was an edible shellfish, which gives you some idea of the uphill struggle that we knew we were going to have to go through. Don't laugh, because two of them thought it was a Greek island in that as well. So it's obviously an uphill struggle with chlamydia. But the point about chlamydia is this. For men, it hardly affects a man. He might get an itchy willy if he's unlucky. He might get writer's syndrome, which is like painful joints, a bit like rheumatism, if he's very unlucky. And if he's really, 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 really unlucky, he might have a drop in his sperm count. Okay? But other than that, most men don't even know they've got chlamydia because it's asymptomatic. We just don't know. So they're giving it to everybody, obviously, whoever they're sleeping with. For women, it is the single biggest cause of ectopic pregnancy, it's the single biggest cause of pelvic inflammatory disease, and it's the single biggest cause of infertility in women. You couldn't have a disease with a more different effect, and it's young women. It destroys a young woman's life for having children, and it might kill them. Whereas for men, nothing. So the government, in its wisdom, decided they were only going to screen women. They weren't going to screen men. See? And we pointed out to them, you know, that it does take two to tango with this one. I mean, chlamydia, you know, it's not an immaculate infection. You know, women don't wake up in the morning and go, "Good God, where did that come from?" kind of thing. You know, it came from the big hairy guy who's lying next to your missus. That's where it came from. You know, and also it sent a very bad message to women. Because it said, basically, if you're only going to screen women, it's all women's fault. It's a woman's fault, because that's why we're only screening women. So we insisted from the Men's Health Forum that men should be screened as well. And then the government said, "Oh, no, no, but they'll never take part in the program." Because why should they? They're totally asymptomatic. And anyway, men are selfish, and they don't care about their partners and so on. Wait till you see this next curve. When we convinced them finally to do it, that's what they found out. There's an exponential uptake in the screening program. In some places in the United Kingdom, more men are getting tested for chlamydia than women. And the reason was very simple. It was the way we did it that counted. We didn't try and frighten them. We didn't shout at them. We didn't threaten them. What we did was that very age-old thing is to pander to the masculinity. And real men don't hurt women. Real men don't. And we used the same theory, the same approach over drinking and driving. Drinking and driving in the United Kingdom was an absolute curse. It really was. An enormous number of deaths from drinking and driving. Now it's actually quite low in the United Kingdom. The reason how we did it was that when we started out to try and stop men, we said, "We're going to take your car off you. We're going to put you in jail, and we're going to fine you. You're going to really hate this, lads." And it made absolutely no effect whatsoever. Absolutely none. It was almost similar to the cigarette smoking, where we tried to threaten men over cigarette smoking. So do you know what happened? A cigarette called Death was manufactured. It was one of the best-selling cigarettes you could imagine. And it was called Death. You remember? It was actually called, the packet was called Death. And young fellas would offer it to each other, you see. Yeah. No, what we did instead with drinking and driving was we showed pictures on the television of a guy drinking and then killing women and children. And almost overnight, the drinking and driving rates went down. And we did the same thing with chlamydia. We pandered to the masculinity of the man, where we're saying real men don't destroy young women's lives. And this is the result. So the reason why I'm showing you this is because that fatalism plagues the medical profession, plagues public health, unfortunately, to some extent as well, about fatalism, that men will never take part. Men are selfish. Men don't care about their health. You know, they don't care about their partner's health and so on. All myths, but yet powerful myths, and they have to be addressed, and that's what this slide does. We had a request from BT. BT is it's now an international group now, but it used to be a UK communications. Oh, sorry. Right? Thanks. Well, I'll keep an eye on this one here. The BT is a communications company. It's very powerful in the UK and now is an international. And the head of occupational health, a guy called Phil Litchfield, came to see us and said that he was having trouble because the engineers couldn't get out the manholes. And I wondered, well, how did they get in the manhole? But anyway, and so they were going to have to buy bigger manholes right throughout the country or smaller engineers, you see. And they worked it out. It was probably cheaper to have smaller, less fat engineers than buying all these new manholes. So they came to us and said, "Can you devise a project for losing weight for men?" So we put this thing together, and basically what it was the men in the BT have to use computers to get their worksheets. It doesn't matter where they work from home. And they have to use a computer, it's called an intranet, rather than internet, intranet, inside the BT. And we ran this program with them. And we were told that, first of all, no man would ever take part in this, because men don't care about the weights. They don't care what they look like, you know, so no man will take part. Out of the workforce, which was 100,000, 16,500 men joined up in the first 2 weeks. That's phenomenal. There were so many men who joined up that we couldn't follow their weight loss, you know, in all of them. So we just had to, at random, pick out 4,500. In the first 16-week period of this program, which is still running, by the way, and now they've adapted it to lots of other things, in the first 16 weeks, those 4,500 men between them lost 10 ton in weight. Imagine. I mean, people like Weight Watchers and these kind of people would kill for that kind of statistic. And the beauty of this is they kept the weight off. It didn't just like a blip and then back, you know, put it all back on again. They've kept their weight down. And this, of course, this one was based upon a very basic premise about men. That is, men, first of all, like to work in teams. They like to buddy up. You think of how many buddy films are, you know, are out there, you know, the two police guys together type thing. There must be hundreds of these things. Okay? So they like buddying up with each other, and they like competing. So what we did was we set likes of Liverpool versus London and so on, and they competed who could lose the most weight. And they really got into this. You know, this thing won a prize, by the way, from a public health body, won a prize for it. So there are ways of doing it. Even what you think is the most intractable problem with men, you can still do something about it. And one of the essences of the whole thing we found is that rather than sit in your doctor's surgery in your ivory tower, you really have to get out there to where men are. I mean, this is true public health now, if you like. You have to go to where men are. I mean, this is a classic. We were just talking about Jon Snow. It was an English physician, and the lovely story of him stealing the pump handle from a well from which cholera was being spread around the area. One of the classic public health stories where the doctor actually come out of his ivory tower and did something physically about the problem, which really should be the essence of public health, you know, in that sense, rather than working in a university and never going out and seeing where people are. So the essence we found here is that if you go to where men are, they will listen and they will act upon health information. We went to the cup final of a rugby cup final. You guys don't play rugby much, but this is big league stuff in Yorkshire in particular. And it was a cup final. And we gave out 50,000 little cards, which basically just gave a URL for a website. Because we knew these guys were using websites. They use websites as equally as women do, if not more, okay? So we gave them these URLs. Now, there were 50,000 of these given out at this cup final. We couldn't give them all to everybody. But anyway, we've got 50,000. And I asked the cleaners afterwards, how many had they picked up of these little cards from the arena? How many had been picked up? You know how many was picked up? 2 out of 50,000. In other words, the men valued these things. They actually put them into their pocket. And this is the kind of thing that we can do, and we know it works. These guys were actually missing the start of the match to take part in very basic checks, checking for hypertension, one of the biggest killers of men. Most men have no idea they've got high blood pressure, and they certainly don't know what the numbers mean and the dangers of them. And this is one of the problems we've got in the United Kingdom. This is an actual poster from the British Department of Education to address adult illiteracy. Yeah, this, I swear. And they wonder why nobody phoned in. You know this. And this is one of the problems we've got with men's health, is that we just assume that men know. They just think, you know, they know. In the UK, there is not one single comic for boys, adolescent boys, that deals with sex and health and relationships. There's about 6 or 7 for adolescent girls. Nothing for boys. And we wonder why they have this weird notion about sex and, you know, and relationships and so on. Because the only place they get their information from is their mate next to them. And he probably knows less than they do. And he got his information off the internet, off a pornography site or, you know, whatever. No wonder they've got a, you know, a strange view of, you know, of health and sex and so on. There's just no information out there for them. And part of this problem starts to kick in when men have children. I see this in A&E. There are two phases to men with a sick child. The first phase is, there's nothing wrong with this kid. What are you screaming about, woman? You know, kind of thing, right? In other words, total underreaction. And then there's the other phase, which is total overreaction, where the guy says, this is meningitis here, woman. Why have you not called, you know, the ambulance kind of thing, you know? Comes screaming into the A&E department, carrying his kids. There's no middle bit. There's no grey area bit. And the reason why is very, very simple. We don't give men any tools on which to use so they can look after children. Women traditionally look after children. It's very rare you see a man bringing a child into the doctor's surgery. It's usually his mum, his auntie, his granny, or his sister. Very rarely his dad or his brother or his uncle and so on. And very quickly, these little boys are picking up the message that health is a woman's issue, not for men. And it's almost ingrained, brainwashed into them. At the age of 18, most young men cannot even book an appointment with a doctor, with a family doctor. Do you know why? Because their mothers always book the appointments for them. And as soon as they leave home, they have no idea how to book an appointment with a doctor. So they tend not to, rather than bother trying to find out how you do that. So we are actually brainwashing our kids into our boys, it could be coming to men, about this. Women would go next door, ask the woman next door, say, has your Johnny got spots? Oh, right, could be measles, or whatever, okay? Or they would phone up their mother or phone up their granny and say, what do you think this might be? For men, there's nothing. There's none of that area in the middle. So no wonder we overreact or underreact. It's not our fault. It's because we're not given the information. We're not given the tools to do the job. That's where the problem lies. So we produce material like these, that big manual, as Solomon was showing you. These come in the UK, there's an iconic manual for fixing cars, and it's called the Haynes Manuals. And these are actually the Haynes publishers. They agreed to do it. I mean, they did it because they want to make a lot of money. These things sold enormously across the UK and were translated into almost every language in Europe. And they worked for a very simple reason. Is that the way that women approach health and the way that men approach health is really quite fundamentally different. Men see themselves very much mechanistically and think about this part of the body here as being the most important, well, second most important part of the body up here, right? Okay? And this bit gets carried around by this bit down here. And this bit lets this bit down. So you get guys coming into the surgery saying things like, it's be pumped, doc. You know, I think it's let me down kind of thing. As if he bought it from a car salesman, he's going to have to take it back, you know, get a refund. But they're very mechanistic. So instead of criticizing men for being mechanistic, why don't we produce material which panders to exactly that, to a mechanistic approach to it? And these are very non-threatening, these books. It's very much sort of displacement kind of approach to the whole thing. So that the man doesn't, there's no photographs in there of dripping lungs with blood pouring out and things like that. We use cartoons and things like that for a displacement. And we've evaluated these things. Every one we do, there's over 100 titles now of these. And they work. They actually change the behavior of men in terms of the use of either the pharmacist, is what we target, or the family doctor. And they're not rocket science. I promise you, they're not rocket science, these things. But they do work. And I would love it, you know, for you guys, you know, to look at how we could produce an American type of version of these things. Because I'll tell you something, what we did, which I was even surprised how well it worked. We were asked by the health services in Yorkshire. Yorkshire is a county just near Lancashire. And we were asked to produce material for Yorkshire men. Now, it was a nightmare. Every Yorkshire man was going to get one, okay? And it was a nightmare because in Yorkshire, there's a massive ethnic mix. Asian guys, Black Afro-Caribbean, Chinese, you name it. Enormous mix, particularly places like Leeds and Bradford and so on. That meant we were going to have to produce one of these for every single ethnic group. Right? We just couldn't do it. We didn't have the money. Logistically, we just couldn't do it. So what we did was this. This is something you can pick from us. Instead of looking for what was different about these men, we looked for what was the same. In other words, we didn't go for what was different from a black man and a white man, or a Chinese man and an Asian guy. We didn't look for the differences. We just discarded those. What we looked for were what was the same. And do you know what was the same in Yorkshire? I know this is hard to believe. They were proud of being Yorkshire. That was it. They were really proud of being a Yorkshireman. The Asian guys were more proud of being a Yorkshireman than being an Englishman. They didn't care about being English. They were more proud of being in Yorkshire. So we designed the whole manual around this basis. And it was massively well evaluated from that. So these things do work. And if it was 10 years ago that things weren't, there was no such thing as men's health, well, this was part of the path, if you like. This is the Vienna Declaration, as it was called, because it was actually put together in Vienna. About 5 years ago now. And basically, it's apple pie. It's calling for governments to address the terrible inequalities in men's health. Bear in mind, the life expectancy of men in Russia is 54 years, right across Russia. That's the average life expectancy. Horrendous. So this Vienna Declaration was there. Now, the reason why I'm showing you this is because when it came out, after about a year of it being out, I got a phone call. And it's some woman ringing from America. There's a woman called April Young, and she was ringing to complain to me, in a sense, that she'd shown this declaration to all her group of men's health, and they wanted to know, why have we not got one? Why have we not got a Washington declaration, you say? So actually, this has gone international now. And these are some of the signatures. You can't see them from where you are, but some of these are like a who's who of men's health, and also health ministers across Europe. Thousands of signatures as a pledge towards it all. So, this is the situation here now. You can see the Men's Health Network there in the middle for America. But also right across there's Hong Kong, there's Singapore. There's men's health organizations now all over the globe now compared to the way it was in 10 years ago. And so I have to say, this is... Whoops. Here's me and Selwyn, and we're jumping for joy here because you guys are all going to go away and you're going to just get men's health into the agenda, whatever work you're in. I have to tell you, there's been a bit of airbrushing going on here, but only in my case, not in Selwyn's. Yeah. Thank you very much. Sorry, my hearing, as you know, Don's not very good.
Okay. Were there a significant difference stratified by age and ethnicity of men and their behaviors, and did you have that data to analyze?
We don't have it. We know it's true, but unfortunately, we just don't have it. But that incidental death, for instance, road traffic accidents, deaths, suicide, but all the things that happen because of it, but no, we don't have that kind of information. The reason is, it's a good question. Do you hear me back there?
Yep.
You all right, yeah? It's a good question, because we should have that. We should have that kind of information. But unfortunately, we don't. We just know what the result is. And a lot of it's the medical model. The doctors do dominate these areas. You know, and in fact, most of what you see there is not a medical problem. Most of that is a sociological problem. But the politician would have more impact than the doctor.
I think we need to be careful about what we mean by service. It's not the end stage of the process that we should be concerned about, but it's the education of healthcare professionals. And by healthcare professionals, I mean across the board. Take, for instance, clinical psychology, psychiatry. Most of their training is done with women, and when they enter these residency programs, internships, and so forth, you know, most have had plenty of experience working with women. So I think we need more than just expand service, make service more men-sensitive, but improve the quality and the depth and the breadth of education focused on men. Tom Dowd and others have done a pretty good job. And incidentally, we did publish a book similar to what you have, the manual. It was called Men's Health for Dummies that appeared about 10 years ago. You saw that.
Yeah, very good. Very good. So, and you designed that, obviously, the manual.
Yes.
In mind. No, I sort of have to have that.
It hasn't been reissued. It hasn't been reissued. It should be. But then again, maybe the assumption that, well, see, but then there might be assumption that, you know, things don't change. You know, men are men, whether we're looking at men 10 or 100 years ago or today. Men are still men.
So basically, any other questions? Yeah.
Here in the States, we think a little about racial and ethnic disparities, and you showed some disparities by geographic location. Did you look at race and ethnic, for example, acculturation and so on, when you look at these people, when you make those data?
You sort of overlapped a little bit with the builders, so you were talking more about the behaviors rather than what you're talking about is the outcome, you know, of this. And there is no doubt about any humans. It's prisons in cities. Vast majority of prisoners in the United States are male, and there's a disproportionate number of black males in Germany. I refuse to believe there's a genetic difference when it comes to, you know, to criminal behavior as well. And I'm not necessarily so fascinating there, because it's the same thing in the UK, but one of the problems we've got in the prisons in the UK, and I'm sure you have the same problem, so when they're in prison, they actually get good health service. They only use it. But when they come out, very often in the States, they're denied anything health care. So in the UK, they don't know how to use the services very well. So what happens is their health goes down. And because their health goes down, they can't get a job. It's because they can't get a job, they re-offend. So they end up back in jail again. It's a vicious cycle based on health. You know, if you keep them healthy outside of the prison, and also suicide is massive when they leave the prison. Much higher than any prison itself. And they first leave, so it's very, very hard. No, we have to go back to that kind of, but again, it's the medical model. It's things like heart attacks. You know, black after calorie have much higher than calorie. So there's cancer, blood cancer, much higher. So we know all that kind of thing, but in terms of the behaviour side, we still are just scratching the surface of it.
But my second question was about, you know, much of what it took from him was that sort of women are the gatekeepers of health and health care and, you know, raising a family and caring about families. So have you any considerations about bringing women into the fold and saying that you need to teach your sons how to do this better? Yeah. Or, you know, how can you make better use of women to make this happen for men?
You made a very, very good point. In the UK, the most active politicians in health for men's health were women. Every single public health minister, right the way through, were all women, and they were the most active in terms of health of men. But I've got this view. Why should women have to do it? Why should, it's discrimination. Women have been discriminated against, let's face it. It's part of the reason men's health movements actually got a flak from some women's movements. Because they see it as misogyny. And the reason is because women have been discriminated against for every single sphere of their lives. In their careers, in their pay, less than men. You see, women have been discriminated and abused on this basis. And this comes in some really strange places. The British Medical Association, one of the oldest medical associations in the world, used to use leeches when it was in medical. Not still up, but there's never been a female head of the British Medical Association. There's never been a non-white head of the British Medical Association. They've all been white Caucasian males in every 150 years, imagine. So it comes up all the time. But my point to you is why on earth should women be expected to do this? Why is it that it's always the youngest daughter who looks after the elderly widowed father? Why is it never the youngest son? She gives up her career, she gives up her relationships for having children, because she's going to look after the widow father. It's always the woman. And I think we need to address this, because I think it is discrimination. And what I say about what you just said is, yes, by all means, we shouldn't be relying on women to actually teach men. It should be part of a national curriculum of how to look after yourself and how you use health services. It should be taught in schools. I'm really serious about it, because I don't think women should have to do it.
Somehow, you know, young girls are understand this because they grow up to do it.
Now, the bones on the terms of them knowing how to use the system. It's there, but they don't know how to use it. So part of this, you know, part of the program that we're doing with businesses is to give them the tools of how to use the health system. The UK health system is still very, very good. You know, if you fall down, somebody will pick you up, somebody will take you to the hospital, and they will make you better, and they will send you home, and they will look after you when you're at home. That's not bad. You know, so it's still pretty good service, but a lot of people don't know how to use it.
Well, I think that's the I think that illustrates nicely the question I'm going to put to you. And that is that there are always opportunities for specialisation in terms of healthcare provision, in terms of approaches to literacy. There is a risk, and you've already identified it, that the universal system that's universal in intent, but is not supported by universality in education, in social structure, in, to hear what we heard from the opening session, the value in the public as public service provider in all of its manifestations, unless that actually supports a culture of effective use of public service oriented structure, no point in trying. It's not about public option, it's about ensuring that the public option is understood.
I guess what you're asking for is the convergence of public policy and health policy.
Well, I don't see the two as separate, but it's amazing how often
we do it. Well, we do it all the time in this country and elsewhere.
Can I make a suggestion? I like to come away from something with your word, like consensus. If you want to be the patient for it, we work very close to a big organization, and then I'll lobby the European Parliament for a change in thinking, actually, more than anything else. And that is, whenever you design a policy, you know, think about its implications for health. Because every policy that comes out of the European Union has to have bolted onto it the health implications of what they're doing. I'll give you a really good example. There's a mate of mine called John Bolles. He doesn't make sure John Bolles. He was a member of the European Parliament. But he used to be the health minister. And then he became, from the health minister, the transport minister. Now, I was working in a renal unit at the time when he was doing it. And suddenly, the number of transplants, organs to transplant, just suddenly died right up. We thought it was a big scare or something, you know, because it was a big scare about doctors taking your organs away before you're dead, you know, it's sneaky, and we thought it was that. And what it was John Bowis had just released this law for seatbelts. You had to wear seatbelts in your car. I wasn't sure the nightmare would get it, because you were saving hundreds of lives from this. We had no kidneys then. One more question then.
Sorry, just for my Scottish colleagues, I live in Quebec, the country next to Canada, so we're on the same page. But on the issue of policy, I think that, you know, a very supportive policy environment is extremely important. In Quebec, we have an opportunity whereby young parents are provided a one-year parental leave, paid parental leave program, income support program. And what we're finding in Quebec is that, and they can divide it any way they want in terms of maternal leave. And it's interesting to see that young couples are dividing it quite equally between 6 months and 6 months. And the impact this is having on young men taking responsibility for their children's health. And what we haven't looked at yet, and coming out of your talk, is what impact is it having on their own health and becoming more aware of health issues that affect them as men, but also affect them as men within a family unit. And it could be quite interesting to look at that.
Well, what we do know now, Mr. Kelly, thank you for yourself.
You like that show?
I do. Yes, thank you.
Yeah. We do produce some nice knowledge shows.
It
was a good show. Yeah.
Anyway, non Canada. What we do with this, really, what we do is that women bring children to the doctor. Why are they there? They say, you know, well, all these examiners turn. They invariably say, doctor, something feels good. Now, we know that, like what you're saying, men are going to be more likely to go to the doctor with the child. And so, opportunistically, we're going to start with this. So, you're quite correct. Whether or not they're going to be more healthy with themselves, if we'll think of this,